Picture the Puck Tempor helmet that Gustav Larsson,
the duck bill one,
rode way back in 2012. It was so hideous, riders refused to wear it. It disappeared for a long time until Dan Bigham started buying them off eBay to use them on the track, and then he started going very fast. So all of a sudden, everybody wanted the Puck Tempor helmet again, and Puck re-released it. Well, this is sort of like that, but even uglier, I might say.
Welcome back to the Placeholder Podcast, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. It's Monday, February 20th. We have, as always, a huge amount to talk about. We're going to talk about UAE and the sprint off going on there. We're going to talk about Tadej Pogacar and his kind of ridiculous run of form at the moment. Filippo Ganna, is he a GC contender now? No, probably not, but we're going to talk about it anyway. We're talking about EF being good. Very strange things happening. Going to talk about a really stupid helmet. I shouldn't say that. It's actually probably quite effective. A really stupid looking helmet. We'll get into that later in the show. And then this weekend is Omloop. I can't wait.
Oh my God.
For a bit of cobblestone racing.
I hadn't realized.
You hadn't realized, Ronan?
I hadn't realized.
Welcome to the show, Ronan.
My interest level's just like soared through the roof there.
Welcome back to the Placeholders, Ronan.
Thank you. I'm not sure how effective I'm going to be in this podcast, given that, you know, I'm not really working at the moment, so I haven't paid a whole lot of attention to bike racing, hence why I hadn't realized it's opening weekend.
You're in good company there, Ronan.
Cool.
I think only I'm working at the moment.
You can furiously pull up all the information you need on your computer, and like, none of the listeners will know that.
No, well, they will know until now, given that you've just given it away.
That's true.
Thanks, Dane.
You're welcome.
Well, you've just heard everybody on the show today. We've got Ronan, we've got Dane Cash, we've got Kit Nicholson. Welcome to all three of you. Thanks for joining on the Placeholders. Cycling's worst paid podcast. So we really appreciate all of your time, your donations of time. And let's get into it. So I want to kick off in the UAE. We had a bit of a sprint showdown, the first of which was, well, it was early this morning my time. In fact, it was before I woke up, so I had to go find a replay. Actually, I shouldn't say that. It was before I calmed my screaming child down, and so I had to go find a replay. Dane, tell me what happened this morning.
Yeah, we got to see a showdown between Tim Merlier, Caleb Ewan, Mark Cavendish. There were a few other people there as well, but Sam Bennett was there. I should mention his name. He wasn't really in the frame, but you know, there's an Irish person on this podcast, so yeah, it was a really nice opportunity, I think, to see that first showing of Cav with his new team. Tim Merlier, though, was the real winner of photo finish ahead of Caleb Ewan, and it took quite some time for the decision to be made on who won. Looking at the photo, I mean, it's almost impossible to tell. It's a really close one.
I tell me what you guys think of this. I feel like there comes a point where it's a tie.
I think that's right? True.
Yeah. I mean, like, literally, I'm sure that they can go down to the pixel or whatever, but one, that's reliant on the camera being perfectly placed on the finish line, which is probably impossible, right, to get it lined up that well. And two, I don't really trust that the cameras are that sensitive. I know that they can get quite close, but, you know, when you're talking about differences this small, it feels to me like, yeah, like at some point you just tie. I think ski racing does that on occasion. If you get down to the thousandth of a second or something like that, you tie. I'm sure the ski racing fans out there will correct me on that if I'm wrong. Might be. But wouldn't that be kind of is that a better solution to events like this morning?
I can't answer that question, but I did find myself wondering last week, if you wanted to intentionally tie, it would actually be quite difficult to do. And the only solution I could come up with was, if you know, if you were that close with your teammate and you were that friendly that you wanted to share a stage one, you could like hug across the line with your bikes behind you. And that was the only way I could think of to actually get a a tied stage, because even that, you know, if somebody puts their head out of place like 1 millimeter, they're going to declare a winner, aren't they? So I think if you ask either of those riders, they would rather be the winner than share it. Like, none of those sprinters, it doesn't even enter their mind.
But I'm saying that I don't think we really know.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I don't think anyone knows who won that, and I think there was a great sequence of moments when Tim Merlier and Caleb Ewan were both studying the screen together, and I mean, frankly, if I was asked, I would have given it to Caleb Ewan, although that's partly because he's so small and his bike's so small that his rear wheel was in front of Tim Merlier's, by the looks of it, at any rate. And I don't know if that defies bike tech. I don't know. But
that's about right.
It certainly looked like he, in his full kind of physical form, was marginally ahead from my gut reaction. But yeah,
that would be a good tiebreaker. If we can't figure out who got over the line first, who got the whole thing over the line first?
Yeah, yeah.
it's like goal difference.
Yeah, goal difference.
Well, I think, you know, like my brain went to, I always say football slash soccer. I know that a lot of our listeners are in the U.S., but also a lot hate the word soccer, where you have kind of similar issue around like offside on a regular basis, where it's just so tight that you can't. Like, yeah, they can technically draw the lines, but at some point it gets silly, mm-hmm. right? And that was what sort of this morning's sprint, it gave me that vibe. It gave me that, like, what? Why are we doing? Like, they tied. They tied. I'm sorry, but like, if you're that close, if you can't even tell, you just have to call that a tie at some point. Even if, like you say, Ronan, that would be quite frustrating to the sprinters involved, I think.
And they couldn't show us the footage or the image with the pixels that showed that Merlier had won. So I think they just flipped a coin.
I mean, it would be a very cycling thing to do, to have done that, right? Like, you can just sort of imagine some like old Belgian commissaire in little tent at the finish of the UAE tour and you know, flipping a euro just to see who takes it home. Which is frustrating, I think.
I was involved in a photo finish that was probably just about as close as this, but 4 or 5 years ago. And it took the commissaires literally about half an hour to figure out who won, because they with the camera equipment that they have, which is, you know, understandably not the same level of tech that hopefully the UAE Tour has, they couldn't get the photo finish, like the still, to land on the exact second that we that the two riders reached the finish line. And yeah, like, eventually they declared that I had won the stage, and I didn't argue with them, but I do wonder how they figured that out. It was incredibly close.
Were you the most local or something like that?
I was definitely most local, but
so there you go.
While this was going on, I was in the back of my mind wondering, is being the local here going to hamper my chances? Am I on the good side or the bad side of this, commissaire?
Ronan McLaughlin wins the Ronan McLaughlin Classic. Wow. Who would have thought?
Well, speaking of hampered chances, where did Cav finish, Dane? Cav
third.
Watch?
Cav
What's
was,
our Cav watch?
He was third. It was extremely close between the front two racers, and then Cav was, I don't want to say a distant third. It wasn't like he was minutes behind or anything, but he wasn't going to win the sprint. So he was there or thereabouts, as British commentators like to say. And I thought that it was a fine enough showing by Case Bull on the lead out, which is important.
Hmm. Recently, Caleb Ewan was on Garrett Thomas's podcast, which, for those of you out there who like a good podcast, that's a good one. I would say the quality ranges dramatically depending on the quality of the guest, but he often has great guests, and Caleb Ewan was one of them, and he was sort of dishing dirt and talking some smack, and basically said that there was like two tiers of sprinters, one that could actually sprint out of the wheels and one that couldn't. So one set that was basically just shooting for second every time. If they picked the right wheel, they'd stay there, they get second place, they're happy with that. I hate to say it, and I know that this is not, you know, it's very early in the year, it's a new lead out, all the rest, but Cav, from a just pure speed perspective, looked like one of the latter in today's particular finish. Again, with all those other caveats, but he didn't look like he was going to be coming around anybody at the end of that race.
it would have been fascinating to see had Cav actually got Caleb Ewan's wheel, because Merlier and Ewan were just, they definitely were, you know, head and shoulders above everybody else in that reduced group after, I haven't seen the stage, but presumably given there was Etzelons and that, it was a hard enough stage, and they were super fast in the finish there. But Cav, actually, to be fair to him, you know, he wasn't on Ewan's wheel, and it was one of those that the speeds were so high, had he been on the wheel, you know, the draft that he was getting there could have made a huge difference. I don't know whether he could have came out in the round or even, you know, but he despite not being in the draft, he was sort of holding that gap to the two faster finishers. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I can see what you're saying there, but I in this instance, I think I have to give him the benefit of the doubt in that he was badly placed. You know, just getting well placed in a small group like that might seem easy, but you know, the other thing is that everybody in that group is fighting for position, and he had one teammate there, but it wouldn't have been as easy as it looked. And I think, I wouldn't judge Cav's chances based on that one sprint.
No, I definitely would not suggest such a thing. I just don't think it looked to me like he had the acceleration today. Like, again, just the caveat being that was just today. We're not gonna make July predictions just yet, but I think for anybody hoping that he was gonna come out of the blocks at full strength, didn't quite look like that to me. That said, he made the front group in a really hard day, full of echelons, and I can't remember exactly what the size of the final group was, but it was what, like 20 riders or something.
The front
like
group
that?
was 13, 15.
13,
riders.
So even less than that. Yeah, so I mean, just frankly, just impressive on that front.
I think for that reason, Cav is pissed tonight. He's like,
probably,
you know, he no doubt used his nous there from years of experience and made the splits, and he was probably coming in there thinking this is as good a chance as I could ask for to win a stage at the UAE Tour.
I think this is worth, I don't know, maybe this is a hollow argument, but he is from a very different generation of bike racing. And, you know, Caleb Ewan's got something to prove. Tim Merlier is on a new team with a new crew. And, you know, he's also not... Well, both the Quickstep leadouts have had problems so far this year. I know we're very, as we've said many times already, we're very early. But Cav is from that guard where, you know, we peak in July and that's it. And this is his second race with... his third race if you include the Muscat Classic, which he DNF'd. It's his second stage race with Astana, and he had a pretty turbulent start to the year with the court case that he was dealing with. So there's a lot to unpick with the Cav situation. I think I saw he posted on Instagram that it was obviously the usual social media caveats, it's not real life, but he was he said he really enjoyed today's stage and the Isle of Man-esque crosswinds and reacting to the situation on the road. Obviously he got himself into a very good position, and if he has a full lead out, you know, he's up there for a podium, for a few more podiums.
I did not know where you were going with the Isle of Man-esque.
He has to be the first person in history to compare a Persian Gulf city.
It's
to
windy.
The Isle of Man.
Rather like Edinburgh, just off the water. You've got lots of wind.
And lush green.
It wasn't my comparison. It was Cav's.
I think it was the four lane motorways that he was talking about.
Well, moving on from sprints, Cav watch completed. On the GC side, those echelons did do some damage to Yates's chances of Enepoel, advantage of Enepoel at this point.
Yeah, the fact that the first stage had such a big crosswind kerfuffle left a bunch of riders, including Yates, I think would be the big one to note among them, well behind those top 11 riders, who included a lot of sprinters, but also Remco Evenepoel and Luke Plapp and Peo Bilbao. So those riders have to be liking their chances for the overall. Yates, I think, has to have wanted more out of this stage. He has won this race before. This is a race he's actually tended to do quite well at, so I know it's a race that maybe we don't focus that much on, but I think Adam Yates really likes to do well at this race, so he's probably not loving the events of today.
And he'd have very good reason to be complaining to some of his teammates, because if you watch the moment that Remco and the Sudal Quickstep riders went on, I'll just take a moment to remember the name of the team at this point of the season. But no, if you watch that moment when they break away, it's UAE looking around, and they do that classic kind of breaking the group. And UAE were at the exact moment of fracture. So it's completely their fault that they're in the position that they're in. And it's quite, so if they're analysing that footage, some people are going to be getting some uncomfortable, questions maybe.
And again, it's a UAE tour. We may not talk that much about it, but if you're riding for the UAE team, you probably do have some, I don't want to say sponsor pressure, but I'm sure there's heightened interest over there in doing well at this race.
I would think so.
The home race in very, very, very accentuated bunny ear finger thingy, which is, you know.
Speaking of UAE, do you guys know that Tadej Pogacar has won at least one stage of every stage race he's entered since the 2020 Dauphiné?
I think what you mean is he's made a mockery of the season so far.
That stat, courtesy of Pro Cycling Stats, but I read it in Adam Beckett piece in Cycling Weekly this morning, and it stood out to me because, yeah, it's kind of shocking that he just literally hasn't had a single stage race off, basically, in 3 years, and doesn't show any signs of slowing down. And I'm trying to think of there's no other rider this spring who's had, I guess, quite so dominant an effect on the races he's been in.
And we talked about this last show, but it's so, I love how diverse the routes are that he's winning on, and the kinds of races that he's winning. It's yes, he's Tadej Pogacar, he's a Tour de France winner, but it's really every kind of race other than maybe a straight up bunch sprint. He's a threat in and he cares about, and it's February and he's still out there winning races. And that's, I think, awesome for the sport. It bodes well. If you're a race that wants to kind of start up, if you're a smaller race that wants to attract fans, you know, in the shadow of something like the Tour de France, it's really nice when the guy that wins the Tour de France, you know, twice will come to your smaller, you know, these aren't tiny races, but they're not nearly as big as races later in the season. And Tadej Pogacar's there and he's clearly in form. And that's, I think, really good for the sport.
It's just a shame he didn't take the KOM jersey as well as everything else at the Ruta del Sol, really. That's just, three out of five stages and not the KOM jersey.
How disappointed do you reckon he is that he didn't win five out of five
stages? Well, one of his teammates won one of them, so he's, you know, obliged to be quite pleased with that. Tim Wellens doing his early season form.
So I guess Omar Fraile is the only rider in the world who can challenge Tadej Pogacar. That's what you're saying. He's the only one who runs.
That's exactly what I'm saying, yeah. and actually, interestingly, though, on that stage, Tadej Pogacar was doing a lead out, so.
Yeah, maybe not.
Fraile didn't want to win it that bad. Yeah.
Kelly, were you by any chance looking up how that, it's his 50th career one, isn't it? And how that compares to Eddie Merckx at the same age?
I was not, actually.
Okay, should I have
been? And?
How does it compare?
So I don't know, like, are they 24 years and how many days? But, you know, if we take the actual year, so Eddie Merckx would have been 24 in 1969. Merckx's tally is anywhere between 54, which is including three stages. I was going to say three stages at Valenciana, but it wasn't Valenciana this weekend. It was a different race, so never mind that. But anywhere from 54 stage or race victories to all the way up to 80. So at the moment, Pogacar is almost neck and neck with Eddie Merckx in terms of wins by his 24th year. But let's see where he is at the end of the year.
As I was going to say, I think Merckx started later, so I think those were more compact. I think he was even more dominant in the races he was actually in, because I'm trying to remember now off the top of my head without looking at the stats, but if I remember correctly, he didn't turn professional until 21, which is the year that Tadej won the Tour de France already.
Well,
that's just silly.
Well, Pogacar is going to have a bit of a rival relatively soon here. Paris-Nice starts on March 5th, and guess who's going to be there?
Is it Jonas Vingegaard?
It is.
So the notes say. So I'm glad that was the answer. It would have thrown us. Yeah.
That quiz was that was an open book test, actually.
Okay. Yeah, I had the book open, so that's good. That's good.
So Vingegaard and Pogacar are both going to be at Paris-Nice, and I like that. I like the fact that they didn't run from each other. That often happens. Often the sort of top two contenders for the Tour de France later in the year will split. They'll split. One of them go to Tirreno, one of them go to Paris-Nice, and I appreciate the fact that neither of them has done that.
Egan Bernal is also going to be there, so let's hope.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
Doing
yeah.
good. Yeah.
Hopefully his knee's better. He had a crash earlier in the year that kind of sidetracked a little bit of his plans, but also yeah. Nielsen Palace and Mateo Jorgensen will be there, and I think that's the real test for Tade because they are on flying form, and Americans, I think it's really hard to stop them so far this year, so we'll have to see how well Pogacar and Vingegaard can handle those Americans.
Not to burst this bubble here, but it will be Vingegaard's. Well, Vingegaard hasn't raced to this point this season and didn't really race much after the Tour last year, so I wouldn't be holding out much hope. But what I am sort of interested in is just Pogacar's taking such a different early season calendar this year compared to what he's normally done, and I can't think of any other reason other than just he wants to win everything. It's, you know, he's already won Torino, he's won UAE Tour, so now he's just winning these Spanish races, and he's going to win Paris-Nice. And yeah, like the only stage I did see over the weekend was Saturday, and you know he attacked for fun on the second last climb, bearing in mind it was an uphill finish. He sort of had the stage in the bag if he got to that uphill finish in a good position, but he was taking like insane descent off that second last climb. And then, yeah, Mass had no answer for him in the final climb. It's just, it's fascinating to watch, like, just how much he obviously loves racing. It's a breath, you know, in terms of the GC contenders we're used to, it's a breath of fresh air, really.
And it is interesting how Pogacar does seem to be much more in tune with the entertainment factor than a lot of other riders. I mean, if you look at the races that he's got on his calendar for this year, it's Paris-Nice, as you said, but Strade Bianche, Milan San Remo, Ronde van Vlaanderen, Flèche Wallonne, Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Then after, besides Paris-Nice, the only other stage race he's got is Tour of Slovenia, which of course he'll win, obviously.
Rock, paper, scissors,
notwithstanding. but then you've got Jonas Vingegaard, who's doing the good old-fashioned, 2010s route, where it's all stage races. He's got Gran Camino, the 3-4 stage race this weekend. Paris-Nice, Basque Country, and then Dauphiné before the Tour. So it's a very different way of going. So I think we knew that last year, didn't we, that Vingegaard was the very much more business-like, go to the Tour de France, win the damn race. Pogacar is having fun riding his bike. And not to say that Vingegaard doesn't have fun, but there is a very different way of going about racing.
I mean, we talked a little bit about this in last week's podcast, but to reiterate, there was question after last year's Tour as to whether Pogacar would tilt more in the Vingegaard direction, right? Whether he would button it up a little bit. I said this exact same thing last week, but I'm just very happy that that's not the case, that he's not going to button himself up, that he is not going to change the bike races that he is. That's just increasingly clear. Every single time we see him race, it's even more clear that he is going to kind of double down on that. I do wonder whether he's going to lose the Tour de France again as a result, and how many losses at the Tour de France will it take before he does eventually shift? Or maybe he just never will. Maybe he would just rather lose the Tour and win everything else. I don't know.
I think longer term this could be a better approach, because you know if he's enjoying it as much as he appears to be, he's more likely to keep on just wrapping up every race for fun. And you know, I doubt it very much, but maybe he's just at the point where it's like he has two tours. You know, there are some riders who don't really see the point in winning the same race over and over and over again. So perhaps he's just, you know, he's going to have fun and go to the Tour, you know, all fully prepared as best as possibly can, but not actually hang his whole season on one race. And the bigger sort of question, or the more interesting thing for me, is just how will Vingegaard come into this season? You know, because I think I said it in a podcast last year. I can't remember what podcast, but there was another podcast I used to be on where he did seem to struggle a bit after winning the Tour. And, you know, that sort of attention and limelight and that sort of commitment to get into Tour winning condition isn't for everybody. You know, Vingegaard could be the complete opposite end of the scale where, I hope I'm not right, but you know, theoretically it could be possible that he's maxed out having won it once And you know that's what I'm more interested to see is just will Vinigo hit the ground running this year, or just what kind of Vinigo are we going to get? Because the only races I really know him from are two Tour de France.
Mm-hmm. The Giro and the Vuelta must be rubbing their hands together, because we could have, I don't know if I've seen anyone ask Pogacar the question, what is your goal at the Tour de France? Because obviously, like you say, he's won two. Does he want to get six or eight to beat either of the records, whether you know, with all the caveats. but
I don't know what you're talking about. Can you expand a little bit?
We'll go with six. the impression we get in what is this, the third week of February, we've got a long way before the Tour de France, but Tadej Pogacar is just, he was ill earlier in the season, but he's just got back on his bike and he's just winning races and seems to be enjoying it. And you know, we've talked about how they used to do it. I mean, Chris Froome would not have been winning races in February and not have been going out on these rampages like Pogacar is doing. Because it's far too risky, obviously. Or even Evenepoel bossing the crosswinds today. That's not how you prepare for a Grand Tour, even if it's the Giro. So it's... I've lost my train of thought, but I was, you know, talking about Grand Tours, wasn't I? Basically, I want to see Pogacar go to another Grand Tour, basically. I'd be interested to ask him the question, what do you want out of the Tour de France? Do you need to go back? I mean, there's obviously team and points and all that sort of thing, although he's probably got the points that they need already.
I think the contrast was very clear a couple of weeks back when you had, it wasn't in the same week, but around about the same time, you obviously had Pogacar winning Jan Paradiso or whatever that race in Spain is called, the gravel race. And a week before that, you had Chris
Froome. Did he just call it Jan?
No, I said Jan.
I said Jan.
And then I couldn't remember what the actual second name is. But you know the race I meant. Anyway,
everyone else might as well have gone home after 50K.
On the balance, well, I'd just like to say that listening to Ronan is one of the most pleasant things that I get to do in my life. So in general, I'm not going to call him out when he says one thing, you know, slightly not in the Spanish way. Otherwise, I just want to listen to him, you know?
The point I was going to make was that you had Chris Froome down under calling Melbourne to Warrnambool a training race. It's like, when did you ever hear Pogacar calling something a training race? You know, if you're Chris Froome, you're at the second oldest race on the planet, and you're a four-time Tour de France winner. It's, you know, come on, go and try and win it, and then, you know, that can still be training if you cross the line with your hands in the air.
Some credit for even doing it at least? I mean, that's better than
no, because he took all the attention away from the race by calling it a training race. I have no time for that at all.
I agree. I'm on Team Ronan here. Everyone would have loved it if he just came in and tried to win it.
I'd really like to see him win something.
Exactly.
Maybe waiting for a bit on that one.
I also think he probably didn't try not to win it. You know,
true.
But just this, you know, it took all the headlines from that race, and everything was Froome training race. And yeah, I don't like that notion of a race. You know, if you're going to train, go train. If you're going to race, go race.
Well, on the subject of not winning bike races, EF Easy posted that for a very long time and has suddenly changed.
It's a good segue, but man.
Tune. It has changed its tune. Well, you guys were making fun of me last week for bad segues.
No, that was good. There's nothing wrong with this. I'm just saying, like, JV could be blowing up our phones here. I don't know.
I'm making an effort this week. So, my point being, EF Easy Post, they have already won more races in 2023 than they won in all of 2022. What on earth is happening here other than the fact that they have a new bicycle? Which Magnus Cort said is very fast. New Cannondale.
Hey, it's a Ronan.
What if that's all it is? Like, wouldn't that be really cool? Wouldn't that be awesome? And then it's the best-selling bike of all time now because it just changes your fortunes like that. I mean
that's maybe part of the whole industry, right?
Could be.
Seems unlikely.
We just got to keep talking to give Ronan time to find out what he's actually talking about.
Oh, no, Ronan knows because we talked about it on Geek Warning last week.
I'm just working out, do we want to talk about the bike or do we want to talk about the riders winning races?
I want to talk about the riders winning races because I'm a very big fan of Esteban Chavez, and to see him win almost made me cry. See him win and cry almost made me cry. But also Nilsson Paulus, I mean, we saw him win races, we've been seeing him win races, but he's now up there. I mean, he's been lumbered with, in the recent weeks, the bit of a curse of the second place, it seems. He's been had more than one at least. But it's great to see them winning. And I like their kit. It's one of the most interesting of the season, I think. So I don't know. I'm happy with it.
I do sort of wonder if it's a situation where there are riders on this team who have been getting a few wins here and there. I mean, Paulus, for instance, had gotten a few wins in the last couple of years and kind of showed he had the form to maybe win some more. And I think Magnus Cort, we've known, has been very good for a long time. It could just be that they're getting more and more opportunities at that team, getting the leadership roles that they deserve. Maybe the team has kind of settled on the right guys.
I think you also just have, like, Paulus coming of age, so to speak. You know, he's a rider who was, what was he, third in the World Championships in Belgium 2 years ago? He was right up there. I know I can't remember exactly where he finished, but maybe fourth, perhaps. But he was right up at the point at the end of the results. And it seems now, like, I watched GP La Marseillaise. Trying to get my French right there for Dane.
No, I don't care about that at all. Yeah,
Dane's French is terrible.
No, I don't worry about that.
And it just, like, it struck me at the time that he's a rider in the past who would have had the legs to win that race, but maybe wouldn't have won. And this year, you know, he just bossed that final climb. You know, nobody else really, even the entire group behind, once he made his move, they just weren't matching him. And that was, he struck me then as a rider with the ability to finish towards the pointy end of a World Championships and actually being that level above the rest of the riders in Marseillaise.
Having the confidence to do it too.
Yeah, he just delivered on not only his physical ability, but just all the potential he has in that race. And then you fast forward a week and he wins at Tour de Passage. And then you've got Magnus Cort, who is just, you know, probably, from what I've seen of him, a very sort of tactically astute and very intelligent rider. And, you know, he won that first stage that he won in Algarve just by spotting that, actually, there's a much quicker way to get to that finish line than everybody else is going. You know, and that's, EF for years had a squad that struggled to win because they were riders who struggled to win. And now they have a squad of riders who have the ability to win. And I think that's what we're seeing more so than anything else.
I think we should also point out, I say this half facetiously, but it may be true. TJ Van Garderen has been a DS over that team now for about a year. Maybe he's really good at it, right? Could be. Is it possible that could be contributing? Obviously, he's not everywhere that they're winning, but he's been DSing at some of the races that they've been winning.
Could be.
Yeah, could be.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I've seen, personally, two very different versions of TJ Van Garderen. I've seen the version where I asked him a question at the Tour de France that actually wasn't even my question. I was asking it for a former colleague, Neil Rogers, who was not at the race. And he didn't like the question. And he just stormed off and, like, took an entire bit of fencing with him. I've seen that version of TJ. I've also seen a version of TJ at a mutual friend's wedding where he gave a phenomenal and hilarious speech and was, like, the center of the party and was, like, this super amicable, entertaining guy that I didn't know existed inside TJ Van Garderen. And so maybe he's a very motivating figure in that team. And maybe he's sort of found his true calling. I don't honestly know. But I actually think that's a story worth chasing down. That's worth, like, we should go talk to some riders and talk to somebody of the team. And I mean, who knows? Maybe TJ was sort of historically quite spiky with the media. I think because the media was kind of terrible to him, particularly American media, for a long time. So I don't really fully blame him for that. And I wonder if in his newer role, we could get a little bit more out of him, like get a little bit more of the real TJ into a story or onto a podcast or into quotes or whatever. I wonder. There's more there. There's more to TJ Van Garderen than I think the average American cycling fan has been provided. I'll put it that way.
They also have a new bike.
They're on a bike that we can't talk about and technically don't know
anything about. I mean, like, my Instagram was talking about it on Christmas Eve, so if anybody wants to know more, they can check it out there.
Actually, yeah, Ronan, I don't think you got any of the privileged information.
Nope.
There is a bike. Yeah, they're, you know, obviously they're launching something soon. It says Lab 71 on the side, which is the new, like, premium racing thing for Cannondale. If you want to hear more about that, go check out last week's Geek Warning. The title's something about toasters, because, you know, that's what we do. It could be that. I mean, like, there's a quote out there from Magnus Cort that says this bike is way faster than the last one. Could be that. Probably not, but it could be that.
Don't all sponsored riders say that about all bikes?
Well, he wouldn't say it if it wasn't true.
I mean, he would just not say anything, right? Like, I don't know if you noticed, but some riders on some teams, EF for a while, they're conspicuously quite silent about their bicycles, and perhaps that could be why. So if he's piping up, I do think that's relevant. I don't have a good segue. I failed the segue test here. There's a really stupid helmet out there. Ronan, what is this thing? tell me what we're talking about.
I presume you're talking about the Sweet Protection time trial helmet. Sweet Protection being the brand name.
That sounds like a saucy film with, I don't know, like a 90s film with Michael Douglas in it or something.
Or it could be like you're protecting your sweets from others. You're not sharing. It could be anything, but it's certainly, you're not going to assume it's a helmet brand. With a name like that. But they actually, yes, so Sweet Protection provide helmets to the Uno X, the new, well, not new, they've been around for a while now, but the Norwegian squad. And I actually hadn't realized that until we've seen the time trial helmet, which is striking, to say the least. And actually, yeah, it reminded me of how equally striking their road helmets are. I just had turned a blind eye to them until I seen this time trial helmet. But yeah, basically the Uno X squad at the Volta Algarve over the weekend, that race finished with a time trial yesterday, and the riders from that squad were, including Alexander Kristoff, racing in that time trial with a new helmet from Sweet Protection. And I don't know if he was going very hard in the time trial, but the pictures I've seen of Alexander Kristoff looked like he had the face of a man who looked like he was being forced to wear a helmet he didn't want to wear. he was very angry looking in every photo I've seen of him. But basically, picture the Pock Tempor helmet that Gustav Larsson,
the Duckbill one,
yeah, rode way back in 2012. It was so hideous, riders refused to wear it. It disappeared for a long time until Dan Bigham started buying them off eBay. To use him on the track, and then he started going very fast, so all of a sudden everybody wanted the Pock Tempor helmet again, and Pock re-released it. Well, this is sort of like that, but even uglier, I might say. that's probably the fairest way to put it. It doesn't help it that it's in the team's yellow and black colors, so that doesn't help. but it's excuse me, sorry. It's
so bad that Ronan's choking on it.
I'm just really struggling to find the word. Like, I would say a podcast isn't exactly the best.
No, it's the worst. we'll stick a link to something in the show notes. You can take a look at this thing, or it's on my social media somewhere. It's like, I mean, clearly the intention is to so old, like older. I guess not older. Most time trial helmets, they're trying to smooth the flow from like the back of your head to your back, right? And this one is trying to smooth the flow from the top of your head all the way like a triangle to your shoulders, as well as your back.
Yeah.
And so it basically it starts out wide and only gets wider is basically what's happening here. And it's reflective of a trend that we've seen elsewhere, like the We've talked about the INEOS helmets before, the cask helmets, where they're wearing a helmet that's like eight sizes too big, and then they stick a giant lens on the front, and it basically makes it, it like hides their shoulders with the helmet. That appears to be the whole idea behind this thing, right?
Yeah, basically, it's like a standard time trial helmet is, you know, intended to smooth the airflow onto the riders or around their head onto the back, but this one flares out, sort of. If you imagine the POC Tempor as it gets to like where your ears would be, then flares out even wider, like literally like a deflector of some sort, presumably to sort of deflect airflow around the rider's shoulders, rather than, so you're effectively creating one obstacle for the wind rather than your head and then your shoulders being, you know, two separate things. This basically is trying to force those two things into one. For you know, the helmet itself might not test faster, but when you put it on a rider's head and it hides the rider's shoulders combined, presumably the idea is that it would be faster. Now, one of the things that I actually spotted about the helmet is there is a vent at the front of it. It's sort of a, what is it, like a square shaped vent almost. And I actually, you know, zooming in on the photos and looking a bit closer, that vent seems to feed into a channel around the sides of the helmet, and that channel seems to exit at the rear also. So it's almost, if you imagine the new Bianchi with the air deflectors on the head tube, it's like Bianchi air deflectors for your head. And, you know, the UCI don't like the Bianchi air deflectors, but they don't mind this helmet.
I've been staring at it for a little while, and I think if it were all black, I realize, like, there's something I'm like, this reminds, it looks like Darth Vader's helmet to me. And if it were all black, I think that's all anybody would see. Because of the, like, way that it wingtips out and kind of, yeah.
If it was all black, it would look like some sort of dispenser with that vent on the front. I don't know what it's dispensing, but
I think the point here is that it's horribly ugly.
Uh-huh.
And that we have acquiesced to terrible aesthetics in the pursuit of marginal gains, and it's spreading like a fungus that's going to kill us all, and I don't like it. I don't like it at all.
I will agree that it is incredibly ugly, but it also looks highly effective. And I have spoken to someone who wishes to remain nameless, who has been up close with this helmet, and says it is the best designed time trial helmet they have ever seen. And this person is beyond an expert in the area. So
the trouble is with this sort of helmet, though. The trouble is with this sort of thing is that it's not going to be a good helmet until it wins. Not the case? No, I don't know.
I mean, like, if you have, you know, a fantastic time trialist and is wearing this helmet and winning time trials left, right, and center, then trends will follow and riders will start buying them. But I do also think that the type of rider interested in a helmet like this now increasingly are more and more aware that there is no one helmet that fits all. And the type of rider who might invest in this is probably also the type of rider that will test a few helmets and pick the helmet that's fastest for them. So the only other thing worse, and I think again, Katie, you will agree with me here, is having a helmet like this, or having like the Specialized headstock helmet, and then riding in like Jai Hindley's time trial position. So it's like, or Ian van Wilder's time trial position. Like, it's, you know, that is actually much, much slower than, you know, those riders. If you haven't got a time trial position to match these helmets, they are not going to benefit you in any way. If your head is sticking above your back, like, I don't know, like a cuckoo popping out of a clock. you know, I know you've got sponsor commitments, but just don't wear these helmets, because, you know, not only do you look terrible, not only do you infuriate Kaylee, but you also actually are actually going slower also.
Yeah, you're putting wings on top of your head, and that, like, that's sort of the angle it's going to go.
I would say you're putting a parachute on top of your head at that point. Like, it's
so. It's probably on the Unit X subject, it's probably worth noting that they do have two young GC hopefuls in the the Johannesson twins, Tobias and Anders. One of them won the Tour de l'Avenir last year, so they've got to be their kind of So I should have done my research, but one of them has been playing. Well, I think it was late last season, was really playing among the big boys in some of the stage races at the end of the last year. So that's, I mean, if you can save a few watts with a ridiculous helmet, then you can, you know, get a bit closer to the Evenepoels, Pogacars, Vingegaards, Bernals of this world. So that's got to be something to favour them.
I just think that they're fairings,
mm-hmm.
and fairings are expressly prohibited by the UCI rulebook, and that we should just not have fairings on our heads. I think that that's
is a helmet. See, Katie,
you're falling into the same slippery slope. Like, if you ban time trial helmets, I guarantee you there will be some other development that it comes as a knock-on effect of riders not having time trial helmets.
They just start covering their heads in cling film.
Then we end up with kind of like the current Cask Ineos thing, where they just wear a helmet that's like 97 sizes too big, and because it covers their shoulders in the same way, but the UCI can't say you can't wear this helmet, because they're like, well, it's just my helmet. I just have an enormous, enormous head that I need to put this helmet on. I don't know. There should just be
I think the only rule that we need for time trials is that you're rear end must be behind the cranks, must be above two wheels, your hands must be below your head or something to that effect, and instead of having a UCI commissaire's jig at the start, they have one of those, you know, the signs that you see in an optician that has the letters that get, you know, smaller as they go down the chart, and if you can't read the letters on the bottom of that while doing your warm-up, then you can't start in that position. It's simple as that. So, you know, that would be a test for whether or not you can see where you're going.
All right, we've solved it. We've solved it.
There's somebody out there. You know, like, Ronan is the one who's saying, you know, Kaylee, it's because of your whatever opinions. There's a recumbent Ronan out there who feels about you, Ronan, the way that you feel about Kaylee right now.
I mean, like, yeah, but we can have, like, we can have unwritten rules that we abide by, and that we're just not going to use recumbents.
Okay. You're going to get those emails. You're going to get those phone calls from all those recumbent Ronans.
Here, recumbent's fine, but just not in World Tour racing. And I think everybody will sign up just to say, right, I will not use a recumbent. If you do away with the rest of these rules, I will not use a recumbent.
Well, I look forward to a year and a half from now, when all the helmets look like this and they look normal to us, because that's what's going to happen. I think it's the most hideous thing I've ever seen today, and it's probably really effective, and I'm sure they'll be everywhere, and then I'll get over myself. And that's what I've been doing for years, is getting over myself bit by bit.
The worrying thing is that POC Tempor was so hideous when it first came out, but it did actually, like, you ask any time trialist, is that a good looking helmet? They say, oh yeah, that's amazing. Like, just Bissiger with the POC Tempor. Oh my God, that's just fantastic looking.
Anyway, we just spent like 20 minutes on helmets.
20 minutes on one helmet.
Oh man, I might cut some of that out. we have some really unfortunate news. I don't know a whole lot about this. This is outside my particular wheelhouse, but the news did come across my desk. The Tour Series, which is in what major cities in the UK, is not going to happen in 2023. I know we had a lot of British listeners out there. This is a huge bummer. We've been through similar things in the United States in the last couple of years, where big series have just poof disappeared for various reasons. So I don't know. Condolences. It sucks. Mm-hmm. It's no good for the racing scene. It's no good for the racers. It's no good for bike racing in general. So
it's a real shame in the year when the World Championship is coming to the UK that we can't find some way to. But I mean, they're citing, as is predictable, the economic pressures and local authorities not being able to, I guess, stomach the costs of the closed roads and the various different things that, yeah, the commercial viability of it. It's a real shame, and it's just, you know, with teams folding over the winter, and it's not a happy sight in the UK at the moment, as far as cycling is concerned. I mean, I hope that the Glasgow World Champs have something to do with it, but I'm not sure what they can do really to make it, to spice it up, get some public interest for a couple of weeks in the summer. But
well, like I said, just wanted to, I don't know, send our condolences and hope that it comes back. They are saying that they're going to try to bring it back in 2024. Fingers crossed that can happen. I wouldn't hold my breath, unfortunately, based off prior experience and history in these things, but that would certainly be the ideal. So, last on today's run sheet, Omloop is this weekend. This is going to be a little mini preview here. We've got Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, which is, for those who don't recall, it's the mini Tour of Flanders. It is kind of the opener to the Northern Classic season. It includes a lot of the same climbs as the Tour of Flanders. It's just about, what, 65K shorter or something like that? So very different kind of race, but often won by a very similar type of rider, or won by a rider who's going to win Flanders in a couple of years. That happens quite often as well. Quite crucially, though, never won by the same rider that wins Flanders that year. The Omloop curse. You can't win Omloop and Flanders in the same year.
Yet.
Let's talk about it. Who's interesting for this weekend?
I think it should be noted, before we talk about who's interesting, that last year's winner, is not expected to be there. Ditto for Matthew Vanderpool. It is, of course, Monday when we're recording this, and things always change in the start list department at the last second, but at least as of Monday, no plans for Van Aert or Vanderpool to be there. That said, the Soudal Quick-Step team, I believe that is the first time I have said that this year, and I was really hoping to not get it wrong, so I'm very proud of myself for that. The Soudal Quick-Step team, formerly known as a bunch of different things, always looks good at this race. They have won it many times before, and they are there with quite a few of their big stars, Casper Asgreen, Yves Lampaert, Davide Ballerini, sort of a surprise winner recently. So that's a team to watch. The Trek team has some talent. Tom Pidcock, I think, is really an interesting one. He's been in good form lately. He had an interesting Algarve. Did win a stage there. And then one rider that I think a lot of Belgians are very excited about is Arnaud Delis of the Lotto Destiny team. And I think this is going to be a chance for him to kind of show his talent at a bit of a higher level. If you are the sort of fan who mostly watches the biggest races and doesn't watch a lot of smaller races, you may never have heard of Arnaud Delis, who happens to have won, I don't know, like 9 races last year. None of them were World Tour races, but he is an extremely promising youngster on that team. And I think one to watch, a very fast finisher, good classics rider all around. So I think Lotto Destiny is really excited to see what he can do. He has won several races already so far this year. He's going to be, I think to me, he's the dark horse and one that's going to be really exciting to watch.
The weather could play a big part in, you know, whether or not Delis gets a chance. Like you would presume it's going to have to come down to some sort of bunch sprint for Delis, same as it did for Ballerini a few years ago. But actually, just, you know, something that I had meant to mention earlier and forgot, but it was interesting to see him going so well today in UAE Tour, because there is that, he does now have Delis sort of chomping at his heels. Delis has started the season, he's already got at least one win this season, and definitely is, you know, up and coming. He's also a Belgian rider on a Belgian team. You can't imagine it's going to be too long before he starts looking to be the leader in the same races that Caleb Ewan wants to be leader in. Certainly one to watch. The other one for me is Stefan Kung, based on Algarve, his first races of the season. He's always a rider that likes to go well in the classics, targets the classics, and I think he's been improving year on year. And if he can get through Saturday without a puncture or a crash at a terrible time, as seems to always happen him, even like 2, 3, 4 times in a single race, he, you know, and based on the form he demonstrated just in the time trial, he could certainly be a favourite for that sort of long run on towards the finish in Ninove. It would certainly suit his attributes.
I'm looking at Fred Wright to have a spectacular spring this year. after a great, so he did some really great performances in Grand Tours to a point where he was getting podium finishes, or at least, you know, top 5-10 finishes, and then being known as that guy who, so that probably fooled him in his hopes to getting a win. But in the races where it's all, you know, you get crashes and people are held up, or it's the long runs into the finish, he's pretty decent when he's got to put the power down. So although he's going to be really going for the Grand Tours again this year, the Spring Classics, he's got a lot in his program, and he's going for all the big ones. He's not doing the little midweek stuff. So I'm pinning my hopes to a good Brit to do some good this spring.
I think that team has got a lot of talent, and it's a team that we don't really talk about their firepower collectively very often. We just sort of talk about, wow, Matej Mohorič is really good. But as a team, I think they're actually, and largely because of Matej Mohorič, they're really quite strong in the classics, and they've kind of built that under the radar a little bit. So that will probably work in Wright's favor. People aren't really looking at Bahrain to be a classics powerhouse, but hey, they won Sanremo last year.
Exactly, and you look at the Jumbo-Visma team, they might not have Wout van Aert, but they've got Van Hooydonk and Thijs Benoot, who, if I remember correctly, I think it was the first weekend of the Classics when Benoot and Van Hooydonk and Laporte did the whole kind of, you know, playing off each other, and it was that, oh, hello, Jumbo-Visma have got these new Classics riders, and they are really coming here with some firepower. So, yeah, like you say, you've got the number of riders that can, you know, not a single leadership is a really good thing in the Classics.
Also will be first race for Jumbo for Dylan van Baarle.
Of course,
Paris-Roubaix
that's
champ.
A very strong team, actually.
Very exciting for them that they're going to leave the defending champion at home, and yet they're still going to have three or four riders who could very easily take the win, I think, in the race.
Real quick on the women's race, most of the sort of big hitters will be there. Annemiek van Vleuten will be there. Lotte Kopecky will be there. Balsamo, Lorena Wiebes, Longo Borghini, Marta Cavalli, all going to be on the start line. As a reminder, Annemiek van Vleuten won last year right over top of Demi Vollering, and Wiebes was in third, won the kind of bunch sprint for third. What are the kind of storylines coming out of this one?
One thing with van Vleuten to note is that she did not completely crush everybody at Valenciana the way that maybe one might have expected, just one that one tends to expect with her every race. So I think that's always surprising when she doesn't just crush everybody, and could mean that maybe there are a few other riders who are going to enter the frame.
Like, for instance, Lorena Wiebes, who is the superstar sprinter. I mean, last year she was untouchable pretty much, wasn't she? But this year she is really being pushed to the limit by her former lead out rider Charlotte Kuhl, and the other riders on was it Elise Wiinen?
Yep, it is her.
who have really put their names before us this early this season. So Lorena Wiebes is not untouchable anymore. So this weekend could be this spring could be a really great season for DSM minus Wiebes. And AG Insurance. AG Insurance had two winners this weekend, didn't they? I don't think this weekend is necessarily a weekend for Ashley Moolman, and she's not on the start list, so that would be a good start. But they have got two big wins against Van Vleuten, as we said. So it's an exciting leveling of the playing field.
It'll be an excellent finale, as always. It's the old Flanders finale, right? It's up the Muir and then into Ninove. Ninove, I can't remember how you say
Ninove.
That in
Ninove.
Flemish. Ninove, there we go.
You may do Spanish, Dane, but I do Flemish. Kaylee does French.
It's a fantastic finish. One of my favorites all season, and it's always just such a fun kind of like mini glimpse into what's coming over the next couple months.
Quickly, just in the favorites for the winners as well, you have first race of the season for Lotte Kopecky, who won Flanders last year, of course, but for me, the favorite has to be Balsamo with that Italian tricolor jersey at the moment. She won over the weekend. That's just like, I just want to see that win everything this season. It's just such a good looking jersey.
It is. And it's so true. I mean, speaking of Ghana again, it looks so much better than the rainbows. That Italian tricolor is my favorite jersey in the peloton, I think. Yeah.
Except for when Astana did one for Nibali that had like a weird.
That doesn't count. That doesn't count.
All right, that's it from us this week. I can't wait to watch Omloop this weekend. I can't wait to talk about Omloop next week. We have something else exciting happening next week that I'm not going to divulge too much or anything, actually, right now, other than to say, be ready. Next week, something big is happening. It'll be shortly after we do next week's podcast, actually. So, with
that. Lessamen?
Yes, Lessamen. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Yep. That's it from us this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for leaving us a review and a rating on iTunes and Spotify and all the rest. We really appreciate it. We love you for it. It makes a massive difference. We can see a direct correlation between those shares and growth each week in the podcast. It's still steadily growing, which is awesome to see. If you missed it, we have Geek Warnings as well as its own podcast. So you can either get Geek Warning in this podcast channel that you're already subscribed to, or if you only want the tech nerdery, you can head over and get it on its own on the Geek Warning channel. So you can subscribe over there and never have to listen to bike racing stuff ever again if you don't want to. So go check that out if you haven't already. It's a great, great podcast. This latest one is Ronan and Dave Rome and myself chatting about all manner of things. All right. Thanks to the three of you for joining this week. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
See you.